Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Sukoon, a Muslim wellness podcast by Nasimco. My name is Farhana Kasamali and I will be your host through this journey we take together towards holistic wellness within an Islamic framework. Join us as we speak to community leaders, experts, and mental health and wellness professionals who will enrich us with their healing words, stories, and personal journeys on the path to wellness. So verily, with every difficulty, there is relief. Verily, with every difficulty, there is relief. Quran Surah Al-Insharah, verses 5 through 6. Join me every month as we begin these essential conversations to promote our community's well-being and healing and to begin to unravel the ways in which we as a community can heal individually, internally, and also collectively in unity. Please note, this episode may contain themes of depression, anxiety, and other potentially triggering discussions. If you or someone you know is in crisis or in need of support, please look to our show notes for resources. I'm really honored to introduce our guest for this month, Dr. Hussain Walji. Many of you know Dr. Walji through his amazing philanthropic and social justice work. Dr. Walji is a former president of the World Federation, a former board member of NASIMCO, and supporter of all our regional federations. Dr. Walji is well-traveled, having visited 5 continents as the president of the World Federation, involved in education and relief of poverty in the developing countries. He's a researcher and a writer specializing in directing and producing content for consumers in holistic health, nutrition, complementary therapies, and as well of late in behavioral finance. He has an immense understanding in and aptitude for addressing cultural diversity, having lived in Tanzania, Kenya, UK, and all across the US. Welcome, Dr. Walji, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Farhana. I'm so pleased to be here.
So for those of us who don't know, could you tell us a little bit about your life?
I was born in Moshi, Tanzania, right by the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro. I went to school in the UK, and I finally settled here in the United States, in Dallas first, and then moved to California, lived in wonderful, you know, city called Irvine. And now I am in hot, humid Houston, as you well know, friend.
Yes, it's a beautiful city, though.
It is.
So what did you get your PhD in, and what got you interested in that topic?
Well, essentially, my PhD is in nutrition. And what got me interested really was when I looked at, through various studies, when I looked at the idea of vitamins being used for prevention of certain diseases like scurvy for vitamin C. And when I looked at the research, it appeared to me that there was something missing. There wasn't an adequate amount of nutrients being recommended by the WHO and other authorities. Now, this is a tall order for me to say that I was challenging WHO. But I looked at almost during my studies and the PhD work that I did, I looked at almost 4,000 studies, did a meta-analysis of almost 4,000 studies over 26 different nutrients and the needs of the body over those. I don't want to sort of go into the whole thesis, but the summary of that simply is that we need far more than the 60 milligrams of vitamin C as an example, compared to what my research told me, that if you are stressed, you need more. If you have a greater disposition to cancers or you have a family history of certain chronic diseases, you're going to need more of those nutrients. And as an example, there's a very interesting example that I came across, which I cannot forget. For example, you take vitamin C. They did a test on a goat. And by the way, the humans and bats are the only species that do not produce their own vitamin C.
Oh, now, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, when they stressed a goat, normally a goat would produce, say, 1.5 grams of vitamin C internally, because this is what nature intended for a body to have. When that goat was stressed, it was producing 3 times as much vitamin C in its body. So we learn from nature too, rather than, you know, purely double-blind studies for that matter. So we learn, you know, even from nature. that this whole idea of us saying 60 milligrams of vitamin C is sufficient wasn't something that sat well with me over my nutrition studies. And I came out with optimal daily intakes for 26 different nutrients. Vitamin C is just one particular case, as to where I did some studies. So that's what my PhD was on. And as I said, I came out with an original level of optimal daily intakes, which was my research, and we call them ODIs. And then that developed into a major commercial tool where people could actually put in their lifestyle, their history, their predisposition to whatever conditions they had, and also based on what their diet was as to what their requirements for those 26 nutrients would be, because really it is a matter of balancing those micronutrients. We talk about from nutrition, we talk about diet in terms of diets, we talk about proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, where there is much more to health than those three, the macronutrients. It's the micronutrients that really make a difference, and that's what my study has been on. I have written 26 books of nutrition, natural medicine. Based on that, my first book was called The Vitamin Guide, and that actually became a bestseller in the United Kingdom in those days.
Yeah, that's amazing. That sounds really interesting. Did you find any connections between nutrients and mental health? Or as you were kind of studying nutrients throughout getting your PhD, did you see anything that kind of triggered a memory of, something Islamic or something within our own Shia faith?
Well, I mean, when it comes to the idea of the connection between food and mood, and actually recall writing an article many years ago when I used to edit the Vitamin Connection magazine back in the UK, I wrote a piece called Mood Food. And foods absolutely have an impact on our mental well-being. And there are certain foods that would certainly be required. One of them really is tryptophan. Tryptophan has a particular impact. Unfortunately, tryptophan as a supplement is banned in certain countries for various reasons. But it's a great example. I mean, when you say you'd like to have a glass of hot milk at night before going to sleep, well, what is it? There's no sedative in that milk. It's the level of tryptophan in that milk that is going to give you that sense of peace and serenity. And there are many herbals. When you look at the Yunani Tib, the Islamic medicine, as it were, there are many herbal remedies that are recommended. Within the Western culture, the herbs that we normally use here, you would have something like passiflora, which, by the way, comes from the lovely passion fruit that we used to eat in East Africa. Passiflora is actually from that. Or you have chamomile, which is a flower. You actually have chamomile tea, or you have chamomile supplements. This is where there are impacts. There's a whole host of information available now on the internet, credible information that you would go to various sources that is going to give you a number of different sources where you can make an impact on your mental well-being and your inner peace. But it's not just physical. When we come to you, you ask me about whether this comes from from our faith traditions. The whole idea of dua, for example, that we are taught by the Aimal alayhi wasalam, when you truly reflect on those words, not a check a box saying, well, I recited my dua Komal on Thursday night and I'm done with it. I'm not talking about that. I'm not saying we should not recite that every Thursday. What I'm saying is it should not become a mechanical check a box thing saying, well, I did. If you truly ponder upon the words of Dua Makarul Akhlaq or Dua Kumail, and just take one verse over a week and contemplate over it, it gives you a sense of balance as to where one is. And truly, if you realize your place in the universe and your place as to why you're here, that gives you a mental stability and a well-being. I remember once going to one of these IMAX theaters, and I was looking at the Hubble telescope documentary. And I don't know if you've seen that, but if you can imagine, the screen where you are, and then suddenly you see the Earth. And then the Earth starts disappearing right into the galaxies, and the Earth becomes no less than a speck. And I'm sitting there in that chair and saying, if that is a speck, what am I? And once it gives you that sense of proportion as to where you are at in terms of the universe and the whole kainat, it then gives you a sense of balance and perspective, that this is who I am, totally insignificant. And when it gives you that, it takes away many emotions, particularly one of ego, and you're able to have that sense of balance and belonging, saying, I belong here, but there is a role, but it's a very, very insignificant role that I'm going to be playing in this universe, and that's who I am. If I can live with that, then I believe that we can get that mental balance beyond the nutrients, beyond the other external stimuli that we may use.
Yeah, so it's not just one or the other, it has to be a combination of both. So like
It's
growing up,
yes, it absolutely is. It's really holistic. And the word holistic is mainly, sometimes misused. But holistic actually means, your body, mind, and spirit all together. And sometimes we have, and again, in jest, I say that the Western culture that we live in has got many great things. But like that Polo mint that I used to eat, enjoy in the UK, we don't get a lot of those here in the US, but you get the Polo mint. And I said that Polo, it's like a Polo mint with a spiritual hole. You have all the taste, you have the beautiful taste of that mint, but there is a hole in it. And that's a spiritual hole that needs to be filled for mental well-being, whether it's, acute, mental health. And I'm not saying that you self-treat your mental health. Counseling has place. Our duas have a place in it. But at the same time, it means that I have to work at it in terms of where my spirituality can take me.
Yeah. I think as we approach Ramadan, when we're recording this, it kind of reminds me of like we grew up overseas. I grew up in Dubai and you grew up overseas. We had all the best foods and the best everything. We thought we had it all in line. But I think as we've come here, we've kind of seen that no, there was kind of a lack of understanding. We did things more ritualistically and that sometimes wasn't as fulfilling. There is something fulfilling to just listen to dua, of course. But I think as we've come here, we've kind of changed our perspective on all the, the fried food and all the good food isn't necessarily what's great for you in the end. So you've done a lot of service to the community. What made you want to give back, after studying for your PhD, and how do you feel that giving back has helped you personally?
Well, even before I embarked on an education project, beyond Tanzania, as a young person, I was, involved within our local club. One institution that really taught me the value that there was something bigger than oneself was the Roundtable Movement that I was part of in Moshi, Tanzania, where I was born. And it was a Roundtable Movement and their ethos of serving humanity for the sake of humanity without expecting anything else in return was something that stuck with me. Of course, we all, as we do, particularly young career professionals, in those days and now too, that we get so engrossed in our professions, developing ourselves, making sure that economically we are stable, financially, that we have what we need and plan for it. Sometimes we forget that there is another part of humanity that lives with us, and that we have a share, being empathetic to the rest of humanity. And if you can get that level of empathy, saying, yes, I'm pursuing my career, but there's somebody out there who needs some help, needs some handholding. If we can have that perception all the time, and I say this to particularly my young friends, do not leave this to say that when I retire, I'm going to serve the community. You don't know whether you'll have an opportunity to even serve. You don't know whether you'll have the opportunity to have even your limbs to move when you're at the retirement age. So for me, it began at a very young age. It has always been part and parcel of my life as such, that public service is something that becomes part of it. And I look at it this way from our perspective as We have been taught to say, you know, there is a level of hukuk, particularly khums, which is 20% of one's savings. Well, I say that there is a khums of time as well. If you cannot have 20%, at least give 5% of your time to community service, to human causes, social justice, whatever is your passion. Give that while you are going through your career, doing your studies, doing your PhD, getting on with your MBAs and whatever that you may want to do. Leave some time. And Allah gives you barakah, you know, on that. And I learned that from a very early age with a mentor, a phenomenal mentor that I had, whom you know, and the whole community knows and can never forget, is Marhum Mullah. When he approached me once, when I was in the UK, just starting, you know, my professional life, and he approached me to say, we need somebody at the World Federation to be able to do various things. I responded to him, I said, give me 2 years. Give me 2 years and I will join, I'll come and serve. I can do some small things for the Jamaat, but I can't take on the responsibility of the World Federation, being a secretary of the World Federation. His words today, until today, remain with me. He said, no, don't ask me to wait for 2 years. You come. You're on a new journey of your own, you know, professional life. Allah will give you barakah. Just give a little time. And there is some time that we must all give. So I heeded his advice. And I got, you know, roped into the World Federation in 1976, just as it was being formed. And I'm still, one way or another, a part of the World Federation until this very day. And that's been my journey of service to the community. And during that, I also learned that in addition to the community, we also have a service towards humanity. My passion is for social justice and equity, you know, on this planet. And whatever one can do in one small way to ensure that we are part and parcel of ensuring that people have that level of equity that we need. And that's what my social justice quest has been.
Yeah, those are certainly inspirational words. And to encourage other people who are studying or just finished studying and focused on their careers, were you able to apply your career, your PhD, your studies when you were volunteering and giving time to others?
Something has to give. You only have 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
So something has to give. So you have to prioritize. You've got family time, you've got your work time, you've got your leisure time, and you've got your community time. Sometimes the leisure time has to give. In my case, and when I look back, whether it was the right thing to do or not, I don't know, I can never tell. But it was also at the expense of family time. Sometimes you had to do that. And I would be, you know, eternally grateful to my wife that she was able to fulfill that responsibility while I was out there trying to serve whatever I could the community. And this has been something that something had to give. In my case, partially it was leisure time, partially it was family time, and also partially it was even opportunities at certain you know, professional benefits that I would have got, something had to give. So you must be willing to sacrifice something. It's not just going to come, because you know this well, Farhana, that the 24 hours fill up with children, with school, with soccer, with everything else that the parents do these days. And I absolutely marvel at how much time and how much commitment the parents are giving to the children. And I respect that. But I also tell my young friends that spare some time. You know, if you miss one soccer practice, it's okay. If you are able to spend that 1 hour, 1.5 hour for the community, for any social justice work, for any charity work that you may be doing, do it. And the other thing that I found, and I learned this the hard way, that every time you have a good intention to do something good, But you say, okay, I'll do it when, my day is over and or when I'm done with whatever I'm doing. And then I'll go and work, and do some work for Nassim Co, World Federation, or Red Cross, or whatever it may be. It never gets done. I have a practice, and I've had that practice for many, many decades, that if I take on a voluntary project saying I serve here and I have to do this project, in the morning, I begin with that project. I spend that hour doing that, and then I leave the rest of the day for whatever else I want to do. So at least I've completed one small task for what I have undertaken that I have volunteered for. It gives you barakah. The rest of the day goes well because you have begun with service to humanity, and then you go and serve yourself. To me, it's a matter of prioritization. To me, it's a matter of saying, what else can I do? What can I do? And if I do this as a priority, otherwise the charitable work, the voluntary work, even if the smallest of things, will never get done if you wait for your daily routine to finish, because the daily routine does not finish.
No, it never ends.
No.
And I think so many of us do the opposite. We wake up with kind of that, the red flag of, oh, gotta get this done, gotta get this done. And it's always, either career or kind of our own needs or our kids or our family, like all good stuff, but still
Yeah.
it's not necessarily charitable or selfless work, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that this should be applied every day, whatever it is. It's, whenever it is. Look, there are important things and there are urgent things. And sometimes urgent things are not important things. If you can understand or define the difference between what's urgent, what's important, and what's urgent and important, then you get your priorities right. And that's the quadrant that I follow. I have it on my desk saying, okay, is this which quadrant is this in? And I think these techniques, help you get more disciplined with your time.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of people in this day and age, we're kind of sometimes struggling with mental health. We're spread too thin, or we just inherently just can't seem to get that balance. We're looking for peace and we're looking for happiness, but we end the day exhausted. We end the day kind of not feeling content necessarily. How do you feel service and giving to others can help a person's mental health?
It's when you look at what you call the power of selflessness, it's very powerful. When you begin to understand that it's not just about me, I'm not the center of universe, or I'm not the center of my community, I'm not the center of my family, that I am a part, I'm a spoke, and the bigger center is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is the center. And if you can somehow bring that about, then you can feel that level of contentment. And then it's something that's hard to describe. It's hard to even practice. It comes when you say, look, there is something out there which is bigger than myself. And the other thing is, how do you cultivate that? And that really is, if we can recognize, I believe, that our interconnectedness, we are connected in this universe with each other, far or near. And our actions in one place will reverberate across a global community. It will affect the lives of many. If you can understand that ripple that's created by throwing a stone or a pebble in water is my action, and if I can understand that interconnectedness, that tells me that I am part of a much larger story. And as I said at the outset, that Hubble telescope image does not leave me to say that on this planet, who am I? I am so insignificant. And yet, if I can make a difference, if Mother Teresa could make the difference that she did, or if Edhi made the difference that he did in Pakistan, for example, then that stone or that pebble that goes into that in that society can make those ripples. If we can emulate, if we can take those as our mentors, of course we have our Aimal al-Muslim to say that, what Imam Zainal Abidin did post Karbala, for example, the ripple that he was able to create in the transformation, through his words, through his du'as and all that. All these are interconnected things. The Imam Hussein's revolution in Karbala sent those ripples that go down until today. When people talk about social justice, it's Imam Hussein who comes to the fore. And this is where, when you look at it, to say, where is that ripple that I can create? And if I can understand that interconnectedness, then that's something that really brings about a lot of things. And when you have your own personal issues in terms of mental wellness, and all of us have this, I don't think anybody can say I'm totally immune from any mental health issues. We all have. It's a matter of degree. In some cases, you need to have counseling. You need to have various other things. In some cases, you can do it yourself. But if you can focus on something else, something that's bigger than yourself, then your own issues become much smaller, and you're able to manage those much better. And that's my theory, that in terms of mental wellness and mental health, I believe that we have to look at something which is bigger than who we are.
Yeah. I know within Houston, we have quite a few organizations do it, giving food to the homeless. There's Hussein's Table, Who's Hussein, and there's a third one. But when you go out and you're actually kind of giving a water bottle or a package of food to someone, when you were, 2 hours ago, just sitting at home, kind of maybe moping a little bit, maybe rightfully just a little sad about your life or something. But when you go out there, not only do you connect with the human race, kind of talking to other people who are homeless who maybe you would have passed by and not even thought about, but you're also connecting with other volunteers. And I've found that both of those aspects are really unique. Because when you talk to other people who are giving back, you're encouraged to do a little bit more and getting out there a little bit more, talking to people you may not necessarily have spoken to before.
Absolutely. It's the power that giving can give you, the power that you can get from giving. And sometimes I'm asked that over the decades of work with the World Federation, what are the highlights of your journey? And it's not the accolades, it's not the big conferences that we attend, it's not the big speeches that we make, to me. Yes, all these things are part and parcel of working for an organization, working within an organization, leading an organization. All these are there. But when you look back, these have been the incidents of giving, an incident of transformation that really fired me. I'll give you an example. When we started the Zainabia Child Sponsorship Scheme way back in the late 70s and early 80s, we were fortunate in traveling to various villages in India, in Gujarat. And we would go and try to convince parents to send their children to school, to say that Zainabia Child Sponsorship Scheme will sponsor your children. At that time, the number of our kids going to schools was fairly low. So anyway, we were in a particular town which is called Palitana in Gujarat. And we visit a home, and he said, "Why don't you send your son? He's now 6 years old, 7 years old. Why don't he go to school? Why don't you send him to school? We will sponsor his fees and all that." He said, "Sure. The work that I do as a laborer on a building site brings in enough money for me to pay rent. And that this 6-year-old boy works on that same site with me, and what he brings in puts food on the table. So now if I send him to school, who's going to pay for the food?" So he said, "Look, we will supplement that, but send him to school." And fortunately, he was convinced, and he did. I'm not giving this story, but there's a much bigger thing here. Many, many years later, I go back to the same village of Palitana, and an elderly man meets me, and he said, "Do you remember you came to Palitana many years ago?" I said, "I met many people, through my life. I don't remember you. Forgive me." But he said, "You came to my house and you asked me to send my son to school. I did. Now I need your help. Now, he's a grandfather now. He said, I need your help. I said, yes, what can we do for you? He said, I just need your guidance. I don't need money because my son was educated and we're okay now. I need your guidance. Which is a good college for my grandson?
MashaAllah.
That is something that fires you to say there's a generational transformation in the small work that you do. That pebble that you threw had a ripple, where now a father who was unwilling to send his son to school is worried and wants to make sure that his grandson goes to an Ivy League college. That is the transformation that we talk about. And that is the passion, and that is the satisfaction that you get. There are many anecdotes that I can relate to say these are those small incidents that really fired me to continue until this day in my golden years where I should be retiring. I refuse to retire.
We're glad you're not retired. You're doing so much good work, Alhamdulillah. That's a very inspirational story. Could you also talk to us about your interfaith work? Because I know you do a lot of that, and that's of particular interest to me. And also talk about the difference between interfaith and intrafaith work.
Okay, so interfaith work for me began even before the word interfaith was coined in the way that it is. You will recall that after 9/11, interfaith became the buzzword. That we need to have interfaith. All of us remember that. For me, even before the word interfaith was coined, we lived in Milton Keynes, and my son would go to a Christian school, a grammar school, where Christianity was a subject being taught. And we opted for him to study Christianity, because I have no compunction in ensuring that all our children study as many faiths as they can. We should have the courage of conviction, saying that we have brought them and nurtured them correctly, so that they will make the judgment for themselves and they will choose the faith. But in this case, once we were called, my wife and I were asked for a conference with the teacher. And now he usually was a well-behaved student, and we never had any issues where complaints had come about him. So we go to the school and we say, okay, what is it? And he said, he behaved very oddly in class the other day. And said, what did he do? And we were told that this was during a class where they were teaching Christianity, and he stands up very vehemently, says, no, that is not right. Jesus was not the Son of God, he's a prophet of God. Now, at
Rush.
the age of 8, 9, 10 years old, he stands up in class and says, refutes what the teacher said. So he said we were very surprised. Why was he so angry, and why did he sort of take up that stand saying, oh no, he is not the Son of God, he is a prophet of God. So we explained to the teacher that, look, this is our belief system. We respect and believe in Jesus as a prophet, and that's what he was taught at Sunday school, and that's what he came up with. And the teachers said, we had no idea of what your faith stood for. Thus began, and they invited us to go to the school, and they invited us to go back to the school, do an orientation with the teachers, saying what Islam was all about. This was in the 80s in the UK, where a school teacher did not realize what Islam was. So this is how far my interfaith journey goes, to say that we need to ensure that we're able to put our faith. But of course, 9/11 created more opportunities for us to do a more interfaith work. We've been involved in numerous sort of interfaith work, but my interfaith work really relates more to us talking about going back to social justice, that we are seeking social justice and equity for all human beings through faith, and we say all faiths stand up for that. So that's, to me, that's interfaith. To relate to what's going on right now in the world, okay, the happenings, and I go out on a limb sometimes saying this, and maybe you will get some reactions when I say what I'm going to say, but I don't hold back, and people who know me that I shoot straight. I don't sugarcoat anything. Today, what is happening in Gaza is not a Jewish Islamic or a Jewish Muslim conflict. It's a conflict that has come off power, ego, and money. It's not a conflict between faiths. And sometimes we take it up as almost that this is a me versus a Jew conflict. It is not. And to me, to view Gaza as a sectarian or religious conflict is incorrect. That's where my interfaith understanding comes in. That when we feel for the people of Gaza, we feel for them as human beings. That is the core of it, that we are all equal. This is what, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made us as different races and tribes, as the Quran alludes to, and we listen to the ayah all the time. The whole idea is that have we really recognized each other's humanity? And if we can recognize our humanity, that is true interfaith work. It's not singing Kumbaya with Christians and Jews and saying, we're all good. No, we have to ensure that we truly not mouth just platitudes, but we say that I feel that you are my equal as a human being. If I can do that, then I've succeeded, in terms of doing any interfaith work. So my interfaith work is really connected, and we have many. Is connected with having humanity as a common denominator rather than saying commonalities in faiths. And we have an exhibition in Toronto in the library that we have created, the Mulaskar Library, the Oasis Center here that you may have seen, that we have these values that we put forth. These are values of humanity, of compassion, of empathy, of repentance, that these are human values, and there are commonalities through the human values. And this is where the interfaith work, in my opinion, needs to flourish. You talk about interfaith. It's ironical that we talk about interfaith, yet we hardly ever, pay much attention to interfaith. Well, I believe that interfaith should be our first port of call. Let us get an understanding that all Muslims are human beings first, that all Muslims have got to be good human beings before they can be good Muslims. It doesn't matter what sect it is. If we can again apply that principle of that common denominator of humanity to our interfaith work too. And I speak to audiences on Islamic City every Muharram, every Ramadan. We have sessions on Islamic City, which is a general Muslim channel. Vastly, it is, of our Sunni Muslim brothers. And I actually talk about these things from a Shia perspective, but within a focus, which is an interfaith focus, that's the way we talk about, and saying, look, it is our common humanity that binds us together. And we talk about the Quranic things, and then the feedback that we get when we use some of the quotations from Imam Ali al-Islam or Imam Ali al-Salam, they say, we never knew this. We never understood this dua. So the idea is for us to reach out, because will we not be asked on the day of Qiyamah to say, but we gave you this beautiful dua, Makarimul Akhlaq, what did you do with it? Did you just recite it during Ramadan and then be done with it? Or did you do anything to pass the message across? And I believe that our interfaith work is equally important in terms of sharing the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, not as a debate, not as if I'm right and you're wrong, but saying here is the humanity, here is the universality of the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Take it, make your own judgment, and take it. So it's a dialogue, it's not a debate. And this is where interfaith work also becomes important.
Yeah. And I think if people, like, if we would remember the hadith, if we would say, people are either, our brothers are either brothers in in faith or equals in humanity.
Correct.
And I think if we would remember that, if we would emulate that, I think, and other people would say, oh, Muslims actually believe this, Shias actually believe this particular hadith, I think that would go a long way in the work that we are trying to do.
That sword by Imam Ali is far greater than the Zulfiqar. Those words by Imam Ali to say to Malik Yasser when he said those words, that you'll find your equals in creation and you'll find your brother in faith. Deal with both of them in a just manner. That is the sword of humanity that can cut through so much.
And it's so beautiful and simple in its essence. There's not much to decipher about it. It's just very clear in how we should live our life and treat other people.
But our faith is so simple. Really, somebody asked the Blessed Prophet, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, said, "What is faith?" And he said, "Doing good. If doing good makes you feel good, if doing bad makes you feel bad, that is faith." Just in those words, he took the entire locus. You can see all these books, on my bookshelf at the back. All these bookshelves are a corollary to what the Prophet said. If this is the core principle, our faith is very, very simple. And all the corollaries that we have are there for our guidance, but this is the core of faith. And that's the simplicity when you're dealing with human beings, and we are dealing with your own conscience, that you be a good human being in order to become a good Muslim, Christian, Jew, whatever it is. The bottom line is humanity.
Absolutely. Could you tell us a little bit more about the projects you're currently working on, specifically the Oasis Center here in Houston, which I'm blessed to be a part of? I attended the last two events and we had an artist that was amazing. And then the one before that, we had a scholar who was also amazing. So if you could talk to us about that.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity of plugging the Oasis Center here in Houston, that you're also a part of that. You're part of a volunteer team, and we are blessed to have people like you and many others at the Oasis Center. Really, the name was thought through. When we were looking at many different facilities here in Houston and elsewhere, we found that there wasn't a third space where people could come without any prejudgments, can could come together and discuss their humanity. Being able to openly discuss, learn from each other. And hence we created what we wanted to call the Oasis Center, that this truly is an oasis where you can come and drink of the fruit of humanity or drink of the water of humanity. Anyone is welcome. The second point about that, as you saw the exhibitions there, that we are looking at interfaith work, that when people walk into the center, they feel welcome. They don't have to dress in a particular way. As long as they're decently dressed, they don't have to take their shoes off. They just come in and they feel welcome. Sometimes, and rightly so, that the mosques have their own regulations, that our mosques may not be the first welcome place. Once they have graduated, once they've understood our faith, then you bring them to the mosque. And I say that the other thing that you do before you bring any outsiders to the mosque is, for God's sake, get all those shoes out of the way, put them in the racks where they belong.
Very
But
true.
that's neither here nor there. The point being that Oasis Center was created on the basis that it's a third space, and to have intellectual discussions. To bring in the diversity of culture of our faith. We talk about subjects, and I'm grateful. So, for example, recent past, to say the Ali Raza Razavi, who amongst many scholars that I approached, and he said, we would like to thoroughly discuss the concept of religious pluralism. And not many would like to actually take that subject. We had a wonderful session. When he had, so we bring in those subjects which are sometimes not discussed for whatever reasons, we bring those in. Secondly, we bring in Jimmy Engineer is a world-acclaimed artist. But more than that, the man does not own a house. The man lives in a $25 apartment in Karachi. His studio has been donated to him by somebody for life. Every penny that he makes in his paintings have been sold in millions, not in rupees, in dollars. That every penny that he makes is given away in charity. He supports 280 families in Pakistan. He does so much more work. So we bring people like those, and he is a phenomenal artist who's acclaimed. So we want to expose our community to these kinds of people, these kinds of works. If you were to look, and I'm sure you observed that, his partition paintings, the
Yes.
partition paintings that he had when he was drawing the Indian-Pakistani partition and the pain that was created on both sides, you can feel that pain in the paintings. And when I asked him, "How did you do this?" he said, "I was getting dreams about the partition, and I had to get it out of my system, so I had to draw it." So art is a form where it's not just for looking, it's feeling. And many a times we don't have the opportunity unless we go to a museum or go to an art gallery or whatever. But this is something substantive that our community needs to engage in, be it calligraphy, be it art. So the Oasis Center is also for that, so that we are able to, bring that diversity in the community. And as you well know, they will get some excellent response, but it's a new idea of having a third space beyond a mosque, beyond a church, beyond a synagogue, that people of all faiths can come and use that third space as to whatever they want to do. And by the
Yes.
way, we serve some very good brunches on Sunday mornings, because that's our most popular time.
Yes, I have had the chai there and it's excellent. And for those of our listeners who haven't seen the paintings that were mentioned, I do recommend checking them out. He does have a Facebook page. And moving on to our next topic with what's going on in the world and Ramadan quickly approaching, how are we supposed to handle the news and find spirituality during this month? Like, I know we mentioned service as one aspect of trying to grow our faith, but it's incredibly difficult to sit here and plan our iftars when we know what's happening elsewhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's that time that we sit back, reflect, and ponder. Ponder from an empathetic perspective, and really empathy is the core of this. If I can feel the plight of that mother in Gaza, if I can feel the plight of that child in Gaza, and then I sit here with my sumptuous iftar, and I think about that. Am I really going to, be able to partake of that meal? Now, I'm not saying that we don't have iftars. I'm not saying that we do not gather as a community. But at the same time, I do believe that in whichever capacity that we can, we need to raise our voices. We need to lobby. Whatever we can, the least we can do is to continue to pray. But not to forget this. Once it gets off our TV screen in the evening, that I watch the news, I watch CNN, and I was aghast at what was happening. And then I go about my day doing whatever else I need to do, forgetting, what's happening out there. We need to be cognizant, number one. Number two, yes, there is a feeling that what difference can I make? I'm sitting here in Houston. Yes, I went to the protest in Austin, or I'll go and do this. What difference can I make? And every little bit counts in whichever way that we can do whatever we can, whether we can do something practically, whether we can join some organizations, who are trying to send some aid to Gaza, for example, or elsewhere in the world. Whatever we are able to do, whatever little we can do, I believe that we should do and we must do. Every person has a different level of capacity. There is not, one rule that's going to fit for everyone. Some have the pen that they can write. Some have the voice. Some, can pray in their hearts. Some, can do other things, be it, charitable projects, be it getting, engaged. Some can do lobbying. With the government, slowly and surely, something will break, something will happen. This cannot, continue endlessly. But, we have to continue to do this. We cannot just forget the plight. But at the same time, we need to be also cognizant that Allah is also out there looking after these human beings. I can do what I can. And I'm sure you know the starfish story, where the old man was watching this young guy throwing starfish back into the ocean, and he sees that young man, goes to him and tries to impress him with his gray hair and his wisdom, and says, "Young man, what difference is it going to make? There are thousands of starfish here on the beach. What difference is it going to make if you throw one out there or 10 out there?" And the young man picks up one, throws it gingerly back into the ocean, and he said it made a difference to that one. And that really is something that we need to ensure that, yes, we cannot boil an ocean. We don't have the capacity to boil the ocean. But can I take a drop and do something with it? I'm sure each one of us can. And that goes back to the idea of humanity. Yes, we continue to pray, we continue to do whatever we can, and think positively on the basis that this too, shall come to pass. And all this will have some ending where Allah, in His plans, will make it better for humanity and for the world. That's all we can pray and hope for. In the meanwhile, we do what we can. Like, that lizard, who was trying to put out the fire of Nabi Ibrahim. And when he was asked, he said, "Ya Allah," I'd say on the day of judgment, "Ya Allah, I did my best." And that's all we can do. That on the day of judgment, we're going to be asked about this. What did you do? And we do whatever we do with a good conscience and intention of doing something good. We can tell Allah that this is what we did. I did my best. That's the best answer one can give you. One can give under the circumstances. Are we capable of, modifying the mindset of those who are doing these atrocities? I don't know. But at least I would try and do whatever I can do. It's my personal responsibility. So that's, what it is, to be mindful and continue to preach this message of humanity, of human justice, and what's happening, that this is not a Jewish and a Muslim conflict. It's a humanity's conflict, and human beings are being persecuted by their fellow human beings. And when you look at it, did you ever realize that we humans are the only species, and I may be corrected, there may be others, but I have not seen any other species that kills its own. It's only humans who kill each other. I've not seen any other species. And we need to learn, and we need to think in terms of humanity. And I go back to the core principles of that social justice, and that's what fires me so much about social justice and what we can do.
Yeah, those are certainly good words for all of us to keep in our mind. So as you've traveled and seen our communities and kind of experienced them in depth, have you seen a rising issue of mental health in our communities?
Let me put it this way. I don't know whether the actual levels of mental health are rising. I believe that the awareness of mental health is certainly rising. In terms of the stigma that we used to have, as you travel, between different places, you find that there are certain places where there's a stigma of even admitting that I have a mental health issue. So to me, it's not that it's higher or lower. I don't have any data, and I'm a person who looks at data. That's my call to say, okay, if somebody brings something to me, I say, okay, where's the data to prove this? So I don't have the data to say, is it increasing or is it decreased? I do have, at least an understanding that there's a greater awareness and a greater acceptance of saying that there is an issue called, mental health. We don't normally call it mental illness. We call it, it's a mental health issue. But in terms of looking at this across communities, it has always existed, the stigma. Now, I think there is one particular demographic that I'm very concerned about. And that demographic, particularly living in the West, where after a certain age, and maybe my peers are a little older, after a certain age, and in the US that I have found that loneliness is one of the biggest issues when it comes to mental health. for the seniors. And our communities, I believe, are doing. Toronto is a great case where so much is being done for the seniors. There are other places where our community in general is doing whatever it can for the seniors. I think that demographic needs to be looked at, that demographic needs to be assisted, and the community leadership needs to be much more cognizant. You know, we talk about youth issues, and the community leadership is very much focused on youth. It's true, I agree. We do need to nurture our young so that when they become parents tomorrow, when they become community leaders tomorrow, they're able to, hold their own. But to me, the seniors issue is equally important, if sometimes not more, because they have served us, they have served the community, they have raised generations. And now, what they're facing, they need to have a sympathetic ear. They need to have a sense of belonging. And I believe that sometimes our community feels a little short in terms of what we can do. And by the way, talking about youth, I have a very different perspective on this youth issue. Again, I'm going out of, on a limb. You may get some comments on that. Youth is not an entity. Youth is a phase. Some of you may not believe it. I used to be a youth once. You grow through these phases. And to actually have say that I don't agree many times in terms of saying there needs to be a youth-specific program or there needs to be a youth-specific whatever. Look, this is part and parcel of growing up in a family, in a community. At home, we don't, yes, sometimes we may make the famous the koja goshen saag along with burgers, but that's the only differentiation we may make. But in a home, there isn't a special place, that this is a youth place and this is not a youth place. In a community, in a jamaat, in our wider society, why should there be distinctions of saying this is a youth XYZ? I believe that one of the biggest, to me, one of the biggest sort of challenges we took on was in our majlises, for example, we separated the youth and the adults. I believe that if we had a community praying together, eating together, would actually stay together. We have, in fact, increased the generation gap by putting in some of these protocols of saying there's going to be a youth program and there's going to be a regular program, there's going to be a main Urdu program or main this program. I believe that we need to rethink, particularly in the Western world, because there is a generation that has grown up. And the idea of separating the youth from the elders, I believe in the religious context, in the societal context, I believe needs a major rethink, that we need to have people praying together, eating together, staying together. And if we go through these phases, the youth of today will not be a youth, 10 years later. He will, and that's where what I mean when I say youth is a phase, it's not an entity. It's an evolving thing. And I believe that we need to rethink some of this. A lot of community organizers, and I've said this in open forums too, they say, look, you don't understand the practicalities. Believe it or not, I do. I have been involved at the grassroots level in Jamaat, be it in Moshi, Tanzania, be it in Milton Keynes, be it in Plano, Texas, be it in Irvine, Texas, California, or elsewhere. I have been there and I see this. And the challenge is there, but I believe that we need to overcome that challenge by having our programs, by having our activities as, as a community together rather than segmenting this. And this is where the challenge lies. How do we have good formulas where we can meet the needs and not segment?
To your point on the epidemic of loneliness, I think it was also Dr. Vivek Murthy also came out and he said that that was the issue within the US. That's what he saw when he went around and saw. So I don't think we should consider ourselves as immune from these issues. I think we should consider it as we were also a part of it. And speaking to the youth question, do you think that segregating, kind of separating these programs also might account for that identity crisis that some kids are facing?
It has something to contribute to it, but I think the identity crisis, and again, this is something I, sorry, I have to sort of swim against the wind, but these are my candid thoughts. I believe that the identity crisis sometimes emanates from where one is trying to find one's roots. And one of the things that connects us with our roots is our language, our vernacular, our be it Urdu, be it Farsi, be it Gujarati, whatever it may be. And I believe that one of the major factors, in my opinion, where we have this issue of an identity crisis is because we no longer speak the vernacular. We no longer have that control over our mother tongues. By the way, I always wonder, as an aside, why is it called a mother tongue and not a father tongue? There must be some reason, but that's another question. You might want to ask somebody in your next podcast as to why. But
I will.
coming back to the point, the language in our culture has a lot to say for it, and losing that connection
Yes.
also contributes to that generation gap, contributes to the identity crisis, if you call it, or at least seeking one's identity. And if you can handle that, if we can be part of a culture, where we came from, wherever we came from, our culture is important, our roots are important. And that is why at the World Federation level, I actually had the Khoja Heritage Project, which does exactly that, where we've created documentaries, we have this Khoja Heritage tours going out. I believe every community, be it Khojas, the other communities, need to think in terms of how do we connect with the roots. The World Federation's Khoja Heritage Project is a good experiment where we had some excellent results, where people do connect with their roots and they say, yes, at least I know where I come from, and now I can. The documentary that I created, the Khoja documentary, if you read the reviews, a lot of young people wrote to us on the reviews to say, I understood what my origins were. I am at ease with my identity now, and I am who I am because I emerged from that, and I'm okay with it. And if we can create that sense through, cultural meetings, through emphasizing whatever that culture may be. Could be Urdu, it could be Farsi, it could be Punjabi, it could be, any other language, Kachi, although Kachi and Gujarati are so similar. But any language. And there is that level of connection that one feels. And then, Urdu poetry, again, is something that connects us. So does Gujarati poetry. A lot of people don't realize, and I actually specialize in studying Gujarati poetry. And the depth that there is in every sense of poetry is phenomenal. But most of us don't have that connection, the upcoming generations. And I believe that as communities, as families, as parents, we need to emphasize that. We should not be shy of saying that I am so and so, I am a Khoja. There's nothing wrong with it. As long as I don't have that complex to say I'm better than someone else. That is for Shaitan to say, not for us. And he said that, I'm better than him. But as long as, we understand that we are part of the human race, that we are, we don't want to be a dull brown soup, in a multicultural society. I would rather be a nice bowl of salad with every color being represented, every taste being represented, which becomes, a far better dining experience, in my opinion, than, your dark brown soup that you have where every culture is now mingled and we are one. And I talk about this very openly, be it the 200 million Shia community that we talk about, or be it, you know, whether we talk about the smaller communities. I do believe that each one of us has a right and must do so to retain our cultural roots so that we don't have this identity crisis. To me, it boils back to my cultural identity.
Absolutely. And we're forever indebted to you for doing all the work that you have to help us understand and keep our identity as Clutches. To end, I do have a fun question. So of all the places you've visited in the world, if you had to pick a favorite, which would it be and why?
That's a tough one. I think when it comes to cities, Cape Town is my favorite. And you've been there,
Oh,
Farhana. You know what that
yes.
place, little
It's heaven
place is,
on
right?
earth. Yeah,
And
it's so cool.
I have two extra reasons where I feel that Cape Town is such a fun place to be.
Of
And that's
course.
because we have two grandkids there
Yes.
who are growing up there, although they are almost grown now. But really, to me, a place which gives you serenity. I love the ocean. And a place that gives you that serenity looking out into the ocean. That's why we loved living in Irvine. You could go to Newport Beach and you could see the vast ocean. And
Beautiful.
the spirituality that an ocean gives. And sitting, you know, in a small boat, right surrounded by water is my fun thing to do. And that's, you know, wherever I find that, that's been good. So for that reason, I find that Cape Town is my favorite place on this planet. I've been to Auckland, New Zealand, which is very similar, but Auckland, New Zealand does have the other two good reasons, as Cape Town does, and so is Vancouver. It's equally beautiful city. So to me, the aesthetics of a city, living sometimes. Yes, you mentioned Houston is a beautiful place. I
Beautiful
find.
in terms of like the amount of food you get, not beautiful in terms of like
Yes.
anything
So
else.
exactly. So sometimes the concrete jungles that we live in,
Yes.
when you go out there, you feel that connection to nature. And I think water to me is the best connection that you can have with water. So that would be my fun place and be there. I could be there, you know, for the rest of my life if I could, and I would actually live there. So
I would agree with you. Both those places are amazing, Southern California and Cape Town.
yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Wangji, for our discussion today. Join us again next month. Thank you to our listeners for joining us on Sukoon, a Muslim wellness podcast by Nisim Co. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on our website, nisimco.org. You can also listen in to Nisim Co Radio, available on our website at nisimco.org, and the Nisim Co app, available on Google Play Store and the Apple App Store. Nisim Co Radio brings you the latest news, insightful discussions, and spiritual guidance from prominent scholars. Tune in for enriching content that brings communities together. Your contributions will enable us to maintain the quality and reach of Nisim Co Radio and the Sukoon podcast. Your support will empower us to continue fostering unity, knowledge, and spiritual growth within our community. To keep this vital work going, please consider donating under General Fund on nisimco.org. Until next time, Salaam alaikum.